Hey everybody, what you're about to hear is a free preview of a podcast on our $5 exclusive episodes tier at patreon.com/retronauts. And if you want to hear the whole thing, please go to patreon.com/retronauts and sign up at the $5 exclusive episodes tier. Once you do that, you'll get access to all of our previous exclusive episodes and our future ones as well, as long as you remain a patron, and our exclusive episodes will launch every other Friday. Again, that is the Retronauts Patreon at patreon.com/retronauts, and I'll let you get to this free preview of one of our exclusive episodes.
So, to really kind of understand kind of what made OutRun so monumental as a Sega release, it's worth looking back at Sega's history and just how important racing was to the company as a genre. Like, you go back into the 1970s, and, you know, from the very beginning, as soon as they entered the video games industry, Sega was really trying to push the racing genre forward. And you go back to, like, 1976, 77, they released a game called The Fonz. And that's as in, you know, Fonzarelli. It's as in Happy Days. It's a licensed game that basically uses the likeness of Henry Winkler and the Fonz on the cabinet to kind of push a motorcycle racer. Because, you know, the Fonz was, before he jumped the shark on jet skis, he was a motorcycle guy. That's where he always, you know, was a greaser, wore his leather jacket all the time. And, you know, it was one of the very first video games, if not the first, to be licensed from a media property. And, you know, the Fonz has nothing to do with the actual game. It's a motorcycle racer, but it's a TTL-based system, transistor-transistor logic. So it's like a custom board, and it uses this kind of weird graphical effect to create bends and twists in the road. I don't know if you've watched video footage of it.
I have not. I've seen like the marquee. And
it like the road, you know, it's kind of a behind the bike viewpoint of the race, which is, you know, really impressive for the time. The closest thing you had at the time, I think, was probably Atari's Night Driver, which
is great.
Basically, it's great, but it's a fake. Like, yeah, it's solid black, and then you have just, you know, dots to kind of define the boundaries of the road. But this actually uses some sort of graphical technique to cause the road to twist and bend for you to follow. So it's a really, you know, if you look at it and consider the technology of the time, it's a very impressive and very convincing attempt to create a motorcycle racer. Jazz, I don't know if you've ever played the Fonz.
No, I have seen it running. There was a very old arcade in the town where I grew up, and they had a bunch of, you know, early 70s machines in the basement, and that was on for a few years. So I was very young when I saw it, but I remember looking at it and thinking, like, wow, that was really cool. In some respects, it sort of reminded me of the even earlier sort of electromechanical machines, mm-hmm, where you'd have a little racing car on a, like on a stick that you would steer
right,
left and right to dodge kind of other things that were coming, you know, mechanical items that were sort of coming down the screen towards you. And so it had that sort of feel to it. So it's sort of, it sort of represents a weird bridge between the true old school electromechanical machines and the modern day video game. So it's, you know, it was a very, very key step forward for Sega and for arcades in general, I think. Because before then, there was, you know, it was all overhead viewed sort of sprint type grand track,
right,
Atari, yep, games, you know. And there was, you know, like you said, Knight Rider, but that was, it wasn't a proper road racing game. It was very clever for sure, but mm-hmm, you know, its racing experience wasn't quite as impressive as the Fonz was.
Right. Yeah. So I'm glad you made that connection, because, you know, Sega did have a grounding in those electromechanical machines. You know, they made a game called Duck Hunt long before Nintendo ever did. But the Fonz did kind of, you know, bring that feel into the video game form. And they built on that a few years later with Monaco GP, which was their final TTL game. And it's more of a top-down view, but it uses that same sort of chicanery, that same sort of graphical trick to create these undulating roads. It's really sort of weird and hypnotic if you ever watch footage. I've never actually seen a Monaco GP cabinet before, but if you watch footage, it's like the road is pulsating almost, like it's widening and then narrowing and then turning, and you have to kind of keep up with it.
I actually hadn't seen this game until it got re-released on the PS2 as part of the Sega Ages 2500 collection with the original version and a remake. But, you know, it's actually kind of fun. Like, it's not bad for when it was made.
Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, Sega kind of left behind the TTL boards at that point, moving over to microprocessors. And after they spent a couple of years working with some different technologies that were kind of co-developed by Gremlin Technologies, who they acquired. That's different than Gremlin Graphics, by the way. That's Gremlin. It's a San Diego-based company, so not the one based in the UK. They developed a hardware spec called the VCO Object System, which doesn't really roll off the tongue. But the game that really broke out with the VCO Object platform was Turbo, a huge racing game from 1981 that, you know, gave you that behind-the-car perspective with the road and the track that narrows and things moving to the side. And that was made possible by this new technology, which I'm going to try to explain it on the technical sense. I may get this wrong, so if you're listening and are angry, I'm doing my best. I'm not a programmer. The idea is that the VCO object system created, you know, on-screen moving objects, sprites, and it had this special like oscillator chip in there that would render each object on screen with its own timing. And it would change its timing depending on how it wanted to present an object. So it would basically create a single sprite and then make it appear to grow larger or smaller by changing the speed at which it was rendered on the screen. So if it wanted to make a tiny sprite, it would render it really fast. So it was drawn to screen really quickly and only took up so much of the scan line time. But if it wanted to make the object bigger, it would slow down the frequency, the speed at which it rendered that object. And so that would cause it to fill more of the scan line.
You've given me more, like I now have more respect for Turbo than I did back in the day.
It's a really like, it's kind of, you know, for someone who's not technically oriented, like me, it's kind of mind-bending. But apparently, yeah, you can like change the way things display by changing how they're rendered. You know, if you have like traditional NES style sprites, you can't do that. It's like it's 8x8 pixels. That's what you got. 8x16. That's it. But, you know, this was custom technology, and I think it was more of a blitter as opposed to just like the traditional, kind of what we think of as sprites. So it just rendered everything with these variable sized sprites. So it was able to create the impression of a road and objects on the roadside and other racing cars growing in size as you became closer to them, as you moved toward them, and created this really convincing illusion of depth without actually having, you know, 3D rendering, without having this understanding of 3D space. It was really just about like, well, this object is this close, so we're going to draw it really fast. It'll be small, or, you know, we're going to draw slowly, so it'll be big. Oh, that object's really far away, so we're going to draw it really fast, so it's small.
That kind of explains the look of that game, because I'll say that was a cabinet that was like a staple of the mid, you know, early to mid 80s arcades. I didn't spend a lot of time on it because it felt kind of simple and Spartan, but it is fun. Mm-hmm. And now I want to go back and like, now I kind of understand why it looks the way it does.
Yeah, I mean, it was a huge hit for Sega. It was, weirdly enough, it's never been released on a Sega console unless it was, you know, like reissued in a latter day collection.
So there wasn't a Master System port at all?
No? There was not a Master System port. There wasn't an SG-1000 port. It showed up on ColecoVision. There were a few Sega games that showed up on ColecoVision, including that and Carnival, that I guess like Coleco had an exclusive lock on them. Like, Coleco actually released a racing peripheral specifically for Turbo. I think expansion module.
I think I had a friend that had it, actually.
Was the Turbo controller. So it was a racing controller. So it was a big deal. And the guy who designed it, Steve Hanawa, ended up moving to America and becoming like the founder of Sega of America. So it was this huge game. And this was the game that Namco ripped off for Pole Position. They looked at Turbo and said, let's do that, but, you know, make it faster, bigger, more impressive. So it's, you know, that next iterative step.